Hello, everybody. This is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Diana Wiley. And I'm very pleased because Gail Scott has rejoined this program. This is Gail's third visit. I love having Gail on the show because she's so authentic and articulate, and she uses her personal trauma, to triumph story. And this included some molestation by her father when she was young. So we're going to talk about trust at the beginning of this program because she says trust is the key factor in the authentic human experience. Welcome to this program once again, Gail Scott.
Thank you, Diana. It's a total pleasure to be here again this evening.
Oh, good, good. Gail is in Toronto, so she's on the East Coast in Canada, and she is a coach. She's a inspirational speaker, writer, and certified coach. She's been a certified coach since 2011, and you can find her website at GailScottInc.com. A lot of times, Gail, we hear people will say, I have trust issues. So let's break that down. What does that mean, I have trust issues?
Well, a lot of people have, when they say they have trust issues, it means that they generally don't trust other people. That's mm-hmm. the first outward expression that people would understand normally with, oh, that person has trust issues. They don't trust other people, meaning they question people, they doubt things, they're always disbelieving. But in my experience, the foundation of that comes from a really strong lack of self-trust
yes.
in oneself.
A lack of self-trust. I think that's absolutely true. And, of course, this often usually goes back to their childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm. For sure. It's normally that they've come from a situation where things that were said didn't make sense, experiences mm-hmm. that they had didn't seem to kind of, they just didn't seem to seem right.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, we'd have parents saying one thing and doing another.
Yes.
My own experience of my mother saying, do as I say, not as I do.
She actually said that, huh?
Oh, she said that many times, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so growing up in that kind of environment where, for example, you can see that there's something clearly very wrong in the situation, and yet nobody's actually addressing the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's kind of putting it under the carpet, and not really talking about it. Silence is the way that we deal with it. We don't talk about those things. There are family secrets that we have. Everybody else in the town knows that, you know, dad's a drinker or, you know, someone has a gambling problem or whatever, but nobody talks about it. And so children grow up in those kind of environments thinking that, you know, it's normal, but it's not.
It's not. And you grew up in Scotland. Was it a small town?
It was a fairly small town, yes. I actually moved three times before I was 10. And so I didn't have a lot of roots anywhere until I really got into my teen years. But yes, I grew up in a small town on the northeast coast through my teen years.
And then you've been in Canada for how long?
28 years.
28 years. Okay.
Yeah.
But you still have a delightful Scottish accent. Anyway.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, it's very nice. So, and of course, when we talk about trust, it's necessary to be vulnerable because I think relationships, well, if they're based on trust, in order to build that bond, we must allow ourselves to be vulnerable. And that's really hard. I know from counseling hundreds and hundreds of people, that's really hard for a lot of people to be vulnerable to, you know, you think of defining moments in your life, maybe the first time you leaned in for a kiss or you revealed something from your past, or you said, I love you. And so these are memorable, but because you had to be vulnerable to become closer, you had to step out of your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. And I think also when it comes to trust, there's an element of safety that's required for a person. They mm-hmm. have to have that sense that they're safe with mm-hmm. the person, with the community that they're in the experience that they're in. Are they going to be rejected? Are they going to be shunned? Are they going to be laughed at? Are they going to mm-hmm. be shamed? What will be the outcome if they risk, you know, being vulnerable in a way that exposes maybe a desire, a weakness, even history, even thinking about, well, you know, this was my past and how are you going to be with this information? Any of those things require you to really be in a safe place, not just within the relationship that you're with, but also within yourself. Will you be okay yourself if you share this piece of information or you do this particular action with this person? I think that's a key component to trusting yourself and also trusting other people.
I absolutely agree with you. And now fear can come in. You mentioned fear. And it can keep people from allowing the self to be fully expressed. And, of course, it comes into sexual relationships, too. But let's talk about fear in a more general way, and then we'll see how it can impact a sexual relationship as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, fear, I mean, fear is a big thing, and there's an acronym for fear, false evidence appearing real. And so when
wow,
we have fear,
that's great.
Yeah, we think that something is a certain way, but in actual fact, it may not be that way at all. I mean, sometimes it might be, but most of the time we're making a story up about what's going to happen, how that person's going to react, what kind of judgment might come down. And so we're making a story. And a lot of times in the work that I do and in my own relationship, if I'm beginning to feel fearful about something, I will say, I have a story in my head that goes something like this. I think if I do this, you're going to do that. And
so you're checking it out with your partner.
Yes.
And
I'm checking it out because it's what I believe to be my reality. I've made it up. And it could be, a lot of times we have our fear based on past experiences.
Yeah.
So perhaps as a child or with other relationships, we were shamed, we were abandoned, we were rejected, we were criticized, ridiculed, made to feel unworthy and unlovable. And so in a relationship, that pattern is running if it's not fully addressed and conscious, because the subconscious is so powerful that we cannot even know that that's what's running us.
Yes, I point out to some of the couples I counsel who are having a lot of trouble with intimacy. Intimacy, of course, emotional intimacy as well as physical intimacy, this is usually unconscious, but that folks have vastly different capacities for intimacy, and some are just extremely uncomfortable with it, and they avoid intimacy, and this is a little bit unconscious, even Freudian, but for fear of being swallowed up and perhaps forfeiting who they are, or because they fear dependency and ultimately abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll get too close to you, you'll see who I really am, and you won't like that, and you'll go away. So the fear of abandonment.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that plays out in the workplace as well with the imposter syndrome, where people are terrified that people are going to see them that they're not capable and they're not able to do what it is that they make out that they can do. And in a relationship, I totally agree with you around that, where if I show my real, true colors, you're not going to love me anymore. You're not going to like me anymore, and you're going to leave me, and I'm going to be left all alone. And then, therefore, it must be my fault, and therefore, I must be unlovable, and then I'm not worthy, and all of these cascading fears come
yes.
up to prevent yes. us from taking the risk of showing our true colors to someone, and to ourselves.
And to ourselves.
And to ourselves. Can
yes.
I tell you a quick story about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely, tell a quick story.
So my new partner, who I'm extremely happy with, mm-hmm. when I first met him, we talked very deeply from the very beginning of our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to understand that I had a pattern of saying the word anyway. So I would talk about something that was near and dear to me, and before I could get into the depths of the emotion of whatever it was, I would say, anyway, and then I'd move on. And he would almost rein me back in. And he would take his hand and he would just very lightly touch my heart and say, just wait a minute. Could we just go back? Let's just go back to just before the word anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know more about what was going on for you then. And it was extremely difficult because he was basically calling me on my emotional state in whatever it was I was talking about. And I began to realize that there were a lot of deeply held emotions around some of the topics that we were talking about, but I had spent a lifetime of just covering them over and not going to that extremely emotional place. And over the months that we've been together, I've been able to actually move forward from that. So he doesn't need to do that anymore.
Uh-huh.
I now become aware, and I've stopped saying anyway. And
yes.
I just talk, and I allow the emotions to flow very easily, and it's become a part of me now. And I can do it not just with him now. I can do it, you know, with other people as well, and I'm not embarrassed or afraid or holding back. And I think that's a true part of being able to be intimate with yourself and with someone else.
And it also sounds like your partner is a good listener, because I think that's so important. Being a good listener boosts feelings of similarity and familiarity.
Mm-hmm. And I think that with the listening,
uh-huh.
it's very important that we get inside the listening. And what I mean by that is that we're not just listening to hear the words. That would be, mm-hmm. you know, level one listening. We're not listening with the intention to respond of how this impacts me. We're listening for what's underneath the words. What are the feelings? What is it that this person is sensing, using all their senses, so that we can really be in tune? And that's what he was doing with me. He was
yes.
sensing what was happening with me at an emotional level, not just listening to the words, which is really true active listening.
Yes, it is. It is. Sounds like a great guy.
He is. He's awesome.
I'm glad he's in your life, Gail. You deserve a good man.
Thank you.
There's another thing that when we talk about being vulnerable, that if I suggest to clients that I'll say, if you're nervous about revealing your true self, you might want to consider this. Do you really believe that your partner's love is contingent on your perfection? And do you expect your partner to be perfect?
Mm.
And likely the answer to both questions is no.
Mm-hmm.
For most of us, a person's, well, we could say idiosyncrasies, are what make them distinctly themselves. In fact, it could even be what you love the most.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I know that from my own past relationships and what I've read and studied and taught is that those are the things that we fall in love with the people for. They're normally the shadow side of ourselves. They're normally, if you're extroverted, you love a partner who is introverted because they help you to get more in touch with that part of yourself.
Yes, yes.
And acknowledging that over time, although that may begin to irk you, it's actually what you love about them, and accepting the differences and really reveling in the differences. And you wouldn't necessarily want someone who's exactly like you, because you'd get bored very easily. And I think we forget that. I think it's important that we see our partners as unique and different, and in the same way that we see our children as unique and different, and people as unique and different, and everybody's walked a different story.
You know, I think especially when people are in their 20s, they'll unconsciously pick another one who is better developed than they are in certain areas. And mm-hmm. this certainly can contribute to personal growth.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. And isn't that just the best thing? And being
yes.
able to improve yourself. And I've personally been in relationships where I've said to this new person that I'm with, you know, I'm on a path. I'm on mm-hmm. a path of personal growth here. I do hope that you're going to come with me on it.
Yes, good, yes.
And in fact, all of them up to this point have not come with me in any way, shape, or form.
Uh-huh.
And I've had to be able to end it. And that goes back to trusting yourself.
Yeah.
Not only do you have to know when to stay in a relationship, but you also need to know when to get out of one.
When to get out of one. Absolutely true. And not just settle because you have a sense of security, but ultimately it isn't secure because you've settled and boredom kicks in. And
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And it also
yes.
begs the question, you
mm-hmm.
know, what are you tolerating? What are you tolerating in a relationship? And if you truly trust yourself and you know your own values and you know what your deal breakers and deal makers are for a relationship, then having that solid foundation of self-awareness and self-trust in yourself
yeah.
gives someone the ability to be able to say, I know I'll be okay if I say this to this person, or I know I'll be okay if I end this relationship. There's a lot of risk involved in trust. There's always the chance of betrayal. There's always the chance that someone will let you down. And so it's about knowing that you're not going to let yourself down.
Very well put. And some relationships can, and I think you're talking about this as well, can help you repair bad things that happened to you in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're talking also about the brain, because the most potent shaping of the brain occurs, of course, in our key early relationships. But it really does go on all our lives, and nurturing, fortunately, right?
Yes.
Nurturing relationships later in life can rewrite the neural scripts from childhood. And
mm-hmm.
I have a feeling from now knowing you over the course of three shows and then off-the-air conversations and knowing all the personal work you've done, you're a good example of this.
Yes, I would have to agree with that. I have rewired my brain without any surgery.
Yeah, right.
Simply by a lot of noticing and
yes.
a lot of understanding of why. I do believe that it's necessary to know why we do what we do.
Yes.
And in the understanding of that, it's made it more accessible to me to be able to shift my brain patterning. So it's sometimes, Diana, it's sometimes so unconscious that I
mm-hmm.
will just drop into something, and then I will either see the result immediately or I will feel it in my body and go, oh, that doesn't feel so good. Why am I doing this? and then understanding that, oh, I've dropped into an old way of being. So, for example, I was extremely codependent before, so I can parent a man if I'm in a relationship with him. Well, nobody wants to have sex with their parent. So
no,
it's
no,
really
exactly.
Noticing, oh, this person is an adult. I do not have to do that, and I need mm-hmm. to change the way I'm thinking and the way I'm behaving and what I believe about that person, in that they can take care of themselves. And really understanding that those family patternings, they're just ingrained in the brain. And when I coach with people, I say to them that, you know, when you're using those patterns, you're on the highway. You are not thinking. You don't have any stoplights. You are just free-flowing or across the highway. But when you start to do the work that repatterns your brain, you're on a dirt track. And you have to continue to walk that dirt track in order to create the change. And we know now scientifically that the neurons that fire together wire together. And we know that when you stop doing those other things, those neurons actually remove the connection. So you can actually physically change the patterning in your brain by consistently, consciously doing something different. And that's what I've done.
And that's admirable. I'm thinking about some recent research on resilience that is appropriate to discuss at this juncture of our conversation. Two psychiatrists, I don't recall their names right now, but they feel that resilience is a skill that can be developed. And so they point out, and of course we know all of this from now, we have functional MRIs that look at the brain. So the prefrontal cortex is the place of cognition and planning. And the amygdala is the emotional center, often wired with a lot of fear from early experiences, right? So
mm-hmm.
if those neural pathways between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala can be strengthened, then the cortex can tell the amygdala to quiet down.
Right.
Quiet down. It's not, you don't have to be so reactive.
Can I give you an example of that?
Please do, yes.
So in part of my tantric training, there's a course that I did which involved learning how to create longer lasting orgasms. And because I had such trauma in my vagina, it would close up. And in this course that I took in practicing how to understand the energy and the pleasure and all of that, I would notice that my body and my brain would go into this place of fear. And I was not in any situation where I should have been fearful. And so my teacher said to me, just tell that part of you to go get a cup of coffee. And so as I noticed this happening to me in the experience, my prefrontal cortex came into being and I went, oh, I see what's happening here. The old patterning is showing up. I need to use my conscious brain to tell it to go get a cup of coffee. It's not necessary anymore to do that. And I would actually physically think that in my brain now. So it's rewiring my brain as I was doing this practice, which I think
well, that's
is
inspirational,
what you're talking
about. Gail. I have a feeling that a lot of people listening to this program will be helped by that. In terms of attachment theory, another Canadian, Dr. Susan Johnson, she says that one way that the amygdala can quiet down is to ask for a hug from your partner. In fact, her second book is called Hold Me Tight.
Mm-hmm.
And not her most recent book. Her most recent book is Love Sense. Are you familiar with the book?
No, I'm not, actually. It sounds fascinating.
Okay. Well, yes. The whole thing, we won't talk too much about it today. But hold me tight.
And it helps you quiet down. When you mention hugs,
yes. Yeah.
Is in terms of being vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of building intimacy and being available for someone, and how many of us actually give a full body hug to another person?
Yeah.
We don't. We are terrified that our thighs are going to touch. We're terrified that we're going to hold them too tight. And yet, it's so true what you're saying that, and we know now, I think it's 12 seconds it takes for oxytocin to kick in when you're giving someone a hug. And yet, it can be one of the most pleasurable, heart-softening, vulnerable experiences and intimate experience you can have with another person, and most people don't hug enough.
That's right. You know, back in the 1950s, the pioneer of family therapy, Virginia Satir, S-A-T-I-R, and she headed up, I used to live in Palo Alto, California, and that's where Stanford University is, of course. And she headed up a family center there, and but she would talk about how we needed up to 12 hugs a day for real personal growth, and most people get less than 3, if any.
Mm-hmm.
But she talked way back in the 1950s about, even before we knew about brain imaging, how valuable hugging was.
Right.
And honestly, we need to be hugged for comfort and to help us quiet down, including the amygdala. And the benefits of hugging, you can be the hugger and you get as much benefit as the huggy.
Absolutely.
Because of the touching.
It's that giving and receiving, you know, where
you're
allowing someone in. And in being vulnerable with someone, in being available emotionally with someone, with yourself as well, you give and receive in any experience that you're having with another person, whether it's sex or a conversation or just touching. It really opens up the ability to be far more authentic and really who you are with another person when you can do that. And it allows space for them to do that also. It provides a safe place for them as well.
Yes, it does. And I sometimes talk about when couples greet each other at the end of the day, that they really need to have a 7-second kiss and a 15-second hug.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's a pretty significant kiss and hug, and it'll get the oxytocin going. And
And an example of that is when I meet my partner now, we try to always have we call it a ritual, but it varies. But it's a moment of some duration where we just kind of check in and get connected with each other. And it takes diligence, it takes willingness, it takes vulnerability. It takes persistence to make sure that that happens. So that example of a husband and wife or a couple checking in and having that time together when they see each other after not seeing each other all day, I think is really important, because oftentimes we're so busy that we just don't make the time to do that.
Yes. That's right. We've got to slow down and make the time.
Mm-hmm.
To connect, check in. And you're right, lots and lots of people don't, and so they miss out on lots of intimate connection and even to a way to reduce the stress.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we know that overt sexuality, but even this kind of cuddling can reduce the stress response. You know, I recently read, this is recent research, not only has partnered sex been shown to reduce people's reactivity to stress, but sex may actually change our brain so that we can better cope with future stress. In Yeah, scientists in 2010 study found that rats, we like to study rats, their brains are similar to ours, actually. The rats who had daily sex for 2 weeks stopped producing extra cortisol, the rat equivalent of cortisol, right? And this led them to act less anxious in stressful situations and promoted neural growth that would have otherwise been suppressed by their cortisol-like hormones. So that's, yeah, it's looking at rats, but it's, as I said, their brains are similar to ours. And
Well, it makes a lot of sense when you look at cortisol and you look at adrenaline and you look at fear.
Yeah.
And you look at all of those emotions that can prevent us from really being fully relaxed. And in that place of feeling relaxed with yourself, then it opens up space for you to be more vulnerable and trusting with someone else, and also available. Are you actually really available to be in a relationship with someone? Because if you're in fight or flight, or you're not relaxed, you're not going to want to have sex with someone.
That's true. I will remind clients, especially, this is especially true for women with low desire, that in fact arousal will need to precede desire, that if they can just let the arousal begin with touching and kissing and holding, and then the desire may kick in, you know, because Masters and Johnson found that it usually is desire, arousal, orgasm, resolution. But in fact, for people that are really stressed or have low desire, arousal precedes desire.
Yeah, I understand that. And I know from my own experience in my past, in my marriage, if I didn't feel like having sex, but then I started to, then if I just went through the motions at the beginning of it, then the arousal would show up, and then the desire would show up, and next thing you know, there you go.
Yeah.
So I still understand that you just said.
Yes, yes. And if the woman has an orgasm, that's going to help her feel even better. I'll give the assignment, you know, I give homework assignments to my clients, and sometimes a woman will come back and she'll say to me, oh, Dr. Diana, you know, I didn't feel at all like doing this, but we had to do our homework. And of course, accountability is part of why this process works, right?
Right.
So she'll say, so we started to do it and I actually got into it and I had an orgasm and I felt so much better. But in order for her to get into it, she also had to dispense with the checklist of things, other things she had to do.
Right, and it's also about being willing to acknowledge the differences between partners that you were mentioning before, and being willing to compromise with your partner and talk things through with your partner, and being willing to say what's going on for you in any kind of situation with your partner. If you're tired, or if you have some particular need that you want, that maybe if they rubbed your back first or your feet first or whatever it happens to be that you want, if you don't feel like you can trust them, that you can be safe enough to ask for that first, and that they care enough about you to help you relax and be in a place where you can be more intimate with them. You know, it takes a lot of communication.
It certainly does.
In a relationship.
A lot of communication, and nothing duplicates it. You know, some people have this notion, if you really loved me, you would know what I want every moment.
Well, that's a recipe for disaster.
It certainly is, and you're right. You know, massaging, well, I give caressing exercises, sensate focus exercises for my couples to do at home. And the first 2 weeks, intercourse is not even allowed.
I understand that practice.
Yeah, it's a good practice because it gets the people in touch. Masters and Johnson came up with the term sensate focus because they felt that people were too genitally focused, you know, and some people will decide to have sex and they go right for the genitals and, and from the top of our heads to the bottom of our toes are all of these possibilities and for touch and sensation and good feelings. And too bad when people get stuck between the legs. They just go right there.
Yeah. And it's also knowing that men and women are very different.
Mm.
Women's heat, their sexual desire and their heat actually generates from the outside in. And men from the inside out. So that's why men have these penises that are, you know, wands of light, as we say in Tantra.
Yeah, right,
and that a
right.
woman has this sacred space, this yoni, and that to my partner and I often laugh because women are the water in the cauldron, men are the fire underneath. Fire can be instantly started. And that's often the case for men. But with women, they need to be warmed up. They need to have the water, you know, taken care of and heated slowly and gently. And that's not to say it's always going to be like that. But with a woman, once that water's boiling, she can boil for a very long time. And so any man who knows that about women is going to have a far better chance of having a more intimate, satisfying sexual experience with their partner.
That's so true. And I really like how you put that. I've never heard that. Is that sort of a Tantra idea?
I don't remember where I read it or was told it.
The heat
probably
is
my
from,
Tantra teacher that told me that.
Yeah.
But it made a lot of sense to me, and we've used it in our relationship in terms of my own feelings and my own level of arousal and desire, and where am I with the water? Am I warm? Am I hot? Am I boiling? And we laugh about it. So it was just a picture that really worked for us.
So where are you with the water? So your heat is from the outside in, and the man's heat is from the inside out.
Yeah, so the man is like fire. You can start it instantly. A man, you know, can get an erection pretty quickly. He goes straight for the genitals with a woman. He doesn't understand that, you know, she needs to be warmed up. She needs all of the sensate experience that you're mentioning that you give your clients to play so that she can, you know, a woman takes a long time to be fully, completely open and aroused in order to have sexual intercourse. And the more aroused a woman can be, the softer and the more open she will become in order to take the penetration. And that's, you know, we know that to be true. And a lot of time, as you say, people go straight for it. And it's not a pleasurable experience for a woman if she's not ready.
No, and there are some other things that happen that explain why it's so important to spend somewhere around 15 minutes in foreplay.
Did you say 15? 1-5.
15 to 20 minutes. You think it's longer?
I would. Oh yes.
Yes.
Oh
well,
yes.
I'm saying at the very at the very least.
I would definitely say longer than that.
I know, but a lot of couples, you know, if they take 15 or 20 minutes, that's a long time. Of course, ideally, sex does not have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, that there's lots of play. But what happens when a woman is fully aroused and has signaled that she's ready for penetration is the entrance to her vagina thickens a bit. The top part of her vagina balloons out, and the uterus lifts up and away from over the cervix. And if that hasn't happened, then during intercourse, the penis can hit the cervix and then the uterus, and that can hurt. That can be uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, and I think that going back to the trust question is, you know, women do well to trust their own bodies and to take the risk to tell their partner, I'm not ready. I'm not ready, or I'd really like if we could do this instead, or in addition, or for a bit longer. And I think that having the willingness to be able to voice what it is that you want and need can oftentimes take a lot of courage.
We're back to being vulnerable,
and
right?
That's a struggle, I think, for many couples.
Well, it is, and it's about being vulnerable in part.
And going back to the comment that you made earlier about, you know, men can't read our minds, and they can't, and women really need to get that really clearly.
Yeah.
That they cannot possibly read our minds. They don't know what we want or expect, and we can change it on a whim. And the clearer we are in our communication, and the kinder and more gentle we are with our partners in having them understand that about us, the more the happier they're going to be.
That is so true. We spoke in a pre-interview off the air about a willingness. Now we're still talking about sexuality, to experiment with a partner, and the importance of being playful, of being silly, which also, of course, requires vulnerability and a willingness to be yourself. But I think it's so interesting that the word silly did not originally mean ridiculous or trivial. Silly comes from the Old English saleg, which originally meant blessed, prosperous, happy, and healthy.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Isn't it? So silliness is a way to feel all four things: blessed, prosperous, happy, and healthy.
That's
so
beautiful.
I encourage my couples to be playful and to bring silliness into their sexual life.
Mm-hmm. I think it really eases up on any feelings of being uncomfortable if you're willing to be more playful. And what I would suggest is doing it in a place where it's not in a sexual arena. Be willing to do it in different areas of your life. Be willing to go out and try, you know, something like improv or role playing art. Creativity. Of course, we know creativity and sexual energy are in the same chakra point. Go out and be willing to be childlike. Go to the playground. You know, ride your bikes. Just do things.
What a good idea, Gail.
And then it gets much easier to be silly. You know, do different accents. You know, just be willing to do things that make you feel good. Because all of these things, when I had my children, I did those things all the time with my children.
Uh-huh.
And it's a huge part of me, actually, to do that. And I realized when both my girls went to university this past fall that if I didn't keep this part of me going, I would lose it. Because I was very comfortable doing it with them. And so I chose to consciously begin to bring that silly, playful part of me into every area of my life. So if I heard a line of a song that reminded me of the song, I would burst into the song. And I would do different accents when I went out with people and you know, climb a wall and walk along a wall. Just do silly things. It relaxes people, and it creates a much deeper sense of trust with yourself and allows other people to be vulnerable and silly as well.
Well, that's right, and I commend you. That's wonderful, given all of the trauma you had in your childhood, that you were able to be such a good mother and plug into your daughter's curiosity about life and have fun with them. And I was able to do that with my children, too, and I now get to see my grandchildren benefiting from my daughter's playful spirit. And I
think the other thing is about not worrying about what the people think of you.
Exactly.
Because, believe me, Dana, my kids are 18 and almost 21, and sometimes they think I'm really weird. But I don't care. I'm just going to be myself. And if I want to hug and kiss them, I'm going to do it. And if I want to dance in my living room, I'm going to do it. And mm-hmm. if I want to skip down the street, I'm going to do it. And I think that the more we embrace that part of ourselves and let go of the fear of what other people think and how it looks to anybody else, then the more we can embrace that in so many other areas of our lives. And who wouldn't want to be fully themselves with the person that they love the most?
Absolutely. With the person they love the most, to be fully yourself.
Mm-hmm. And that's really authentic trust.
That's right. And it makes it so much easier to be playful and to be silly when you can just be yourself and goof around.
The other thing about authentic trust is that mm-hmm. with authentic trust, there's always a risk that that person will betray you. There's always the risk that they will disapprove, that mm-hmm. they'll let you down, that they won't be there. But with authentic trust, we trust that we will be okay whether they do that or not. And that gives us the foundation to be who we really are. Because most of the time, we're either gullible and in denial, or we're coming from a place of, okay, I trust me, and so therefore I'm going to be willing to trust you.
So true. Now, you also talk about the law of attraction with the Imago therapy, and this fits in because you do mirror back with validation.
Talk a little bit more about that. When we were talking off air, I was mentioning to you about this list that I had written. So for the listeners, after I got divorced, I wrote a list, which many people tell you to do when you're looking for a new partner. So this list had 26 different items on it. It was all mm-hmm. different kinds of things that I really wanted this man to be. Mm-hmm. And after the first relationship that I had, I went back to the list to look at, well, was he this and was he that and was he the next thing? And my coach at the time turned and said, okay, so now, Gail, I want you to judge yourself based on that entire list. Are you all of those things? And I became acutely aware of how I was not. I really desperately wanted this man to be this particular way, and yet I was not that way. And so what I realized was that I was manifesting a partner who was just exactly like I was, at the same level of personal growth. And I went to a workshop with an Imago therapist, and she said, you will continue to manifest the partner at the same level of personal growth that you're at. And I had kittens because I thought, oh, my God, am I going to get someone like my husband again and again and again? And she said, no, the more you work on yourself,
right,
the higher your vibration will go and the better you will attract. And so over time, as I would go through 2, 3, 4 other relationships, I would go back to that list again and say, okay, so what's still not okay with my relationships and where do I need to do the growth? And so that's what I did. And it's humbling. I'm telling you, it's humbling to look at that list and go, no, I still haven't licked that one, so I'm going to have to work on that one now.
It's wonderful. With some of my single clients, I give them an exercise that fits with what you're talking about. And so self-images can be deceiving. So you think about others' perceptions and your perception of yourself and how they might differ. So I give them a list and I'll give you the list in a minute and the listeners a list. So you, with this list of descriptors, you circle the words you think would describe how other people perceive you now, and then put a check by the same word you believe portray how you really are. Mm. So you get words, you have descriptors like happy, secure, warm, inadequate, caring, distant, scared, sad, angry, giving, insecure, unhappy, bright, dumb, naive, handsome, homely, attractive, trim, fat, compassionate, playful, shy, confident, anxious, lonely, clumsy, talented. That about covers it, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, if you're measuring yourself up against that entire list, and then you get to see, so who are you really? And that's another tool that I use with people that I work with. So who are you really?
Yeah.
It was the first conversation that I had with my new partner it was kind of a date, but not really. It was on Skype. And we did this exercise together.
So, yeah.
So who are you really? If I really knew you, if you really knew me, you'd know this about me, and this is who I really am.
Wow, that's good.
And it really opens up looking inward at yourself and saying, who am I being? And then what am I getting back from the universe in terms of what's around me, partners, friends, coworkers, situations, health, everything, and looking at that. And looking at when we get something that we don't like, the imago therapy is it's normally our wounded part of ourselves. And we can use the mirroring, both mirroring what people say and mirroring in front of ourselves of what we're seeing, to say, well, how am I like that? Am I like that? Well, I must be like that because it's right in front of me. And that's a very difficult thing for people to accept, because we like to blame and we like to project and we don't like to own what is happening for us when it's being shown to us in front of us by someone else.
Very wise. It's clear you've done a lot of deep personal work, and the great thing about you, Gail Scott, is that you can coach others and explain it just like you've been doing. We still have time, but we're winding down doing mm-hmm. on this program for the last nearly 60 minutes. It's a gift, and I bet you consider yourself blessed in many ways. That
oh, I do.
Yeah,
I do. I
you
feel really
blessing.
Fortunate. I'm very
yeah.
grateful every day for everything that I've been through. And a lot of people say, "Oh, you know, you must regret all those things," and I don't. I've no regrets whatsoever.
Yeah, that's. It shows that you've really done some good work. Because so many people have regrets, and there are ways to avoid regrets, but mostly we have to, as you've been pointing out, we have to really look in the mirror and what are you attracting?
The one other thing I would say just briefly is that if you're attracting an emotionally unavailable person, then look at how emotionally available you really are.
Exactly.
Are you really ready to be in a committed relationship with someone, or does it scare the bejesus out of you? Because that was what I went through a few years ago when I thought I was ready to date. And I had a conversation with a coach, and I realized, oh, my gosh, I am so not ready to be in a committed relationship. And yet out there, everybody says, oh, are you dating? Are you dating? And realizing, well, I thought I wanted to date and be in a relationship, but actually I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And it's good to know that. You need to know yourself.
Right, right. It's very true. You know, I talk about doing a good emotional divorce, and that means that you figure out what was your part in the divorce, the good and the bad, what was his part or her part in the divorce, good and bad. And if you don't do that, you're much more likely to not do the work that we've been talking about and then mm-hmm. to pick somebody. As you've
and
already
you're
alluded
repeat
to that
it.
Fear.
And I say that to people who come to me. I say,
mm-hmm.
well, if you want the same as what you've always got, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah,
and I named
exactly.
this year for me the year of doing things differently, because
mm-hmm.
I wanted different results in my life. And
mm-hmm.
the definition of insanity, we know, is doing the same thing over and over. And so you're so right on that one.
Yes, that's right.
You have to look at who you're being, otherwise you're just going to get the same thing again.
And you're going to get it again.
Mm-hmm.
And if you
and
want,
that's law of attraction as well, right?
The law of attraction. If you want to mm-hmm. date and have a relationship with a terrific person, you must start by being a terrific person yourself. And
that's
that
what
can
they
take
say about
time.
Being a friend. If you want a friend, be a friend.
Be a friend. That's right. And I really like that you would make that you made this list for yourself, and then you would come back to it. Because you had a list of what you were looking for in a relationship.
Mm. And it's funny because the man that I'm in a relationship with now, I had made a list last fall, a brand new list. I can't mm-hmm. find the old list, which is very upsetting for me. But
oh.
I made a brand new list, and about 2 months into our relationship, I brought out the list.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the entire list to him, and I said, you're everything on this list.
Mm-hmm.
And the first item was, you know, is willing to do Tantra. And little did I know that he had taught Tantra himself. And
lucky
so I
you.
Think it's really important that we have, you know, deal breakers, and we know what our deal breakers are about being in a relationship with someone. What is it that we really want, and we will not settle for less? And to do that in a respectful way, trusting
yeah.
that if that person is not able to meet those needs, that we'll be okay. We can move on, and we can find someone who is able to do that for us.
Very, very true. Well, Gail, thank you. When I write this up to go up on the PRN website, and also on my website, I rarely mention this, but my website is drdianawiley.com and dr for doctor, dianawiley.com. So it's on the homepage of my website, too, links for this program. And your website, I'll repeat again, is GailScottInc.com. How did you get the ink, Gail?
I just liked the way it sounded.
Yeah, I do too.
I just like the way it sounded, and so I love what I do.
Yes, it's clear. So, Gail Scott, thank you so much. I think what we've learned here is that life choices and self-improvement can open us up to the potential bounty of our lives. Hear, hear. Thank you. Happy feet, da da da, happy feet, da da da.